views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
This show's audio was via a Skype call.
Welcome to Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasek. Marge was searching for the purpose of her life and the truth that would tie everything together to make sense of what was taught and what was happening on our planet, the fire that was creating all the smoke. Through many experiences, she was finally led to the Knowledge Book that provided all the answers. Marge is now talking about this gift to humanity on Knowledge Book Radio, so all can be united in peace, love, and harmony. This live call-in show at 1-800-930-2819 is amazing. So get ready to hear about the Knowledge Book. Here's your host, Marge Potasek.
Hello, everyone. I'm Marge Potasek, and you're listening to the Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasek on Transformation Talk Radio. For the next hour, as we've been doing for a while, we'll continue to cover some topics from the Knowledge Book and some topics that were requested by listeners having to do something to do with the Knowledge Book. And this week, we're going to talk about orchids, evolution, and the Knowledge Book. We'll be looking at evolution maybe from a slightly different viewpoint, and maybe it'll be an interesting way of looking at evolution and the plant kingdom, especially orchids. But before we go on, we would like to remind you that our website is www.usa.theknowledgebook.net, and the Turkish website for the World Brotherhood Union is www.dkbdavidkiteboy-mevlana.org.tr. My contact information, telephone number, cell phone actually is 973-787-7035. You can text me also on this telephone number any kind of questions or suggestions for topics. And my email address is mmjp99@gmail.com. That's marymaryjohnpeter99@gmail.com. So, of course, any questions, any suggestions for topics are very welcome and actually helps out a lot, because then I know where to target the next talk show and what kind of information to present. So many of the shows that we've been airing recently are as a direct result of the suggestions and the questions that are coming in. So thank you very much for that, and please continue to do so. Okay. Topic of orchids, evolution, and the Knowledge Book. So first we'll talk about orchids. And when we go into a regular store, a grocery store, a big box store, and maybe even specialty flower stores, we can see that the beauty, the complexity, and the incredible diversity of orchid flowers are unrivaled in the plant world. So these are exotic beauties, and they are the largest family of flowering plants on Earth. They have over 30,000 different species. I mean, that number varies depending on who's doing the counting, but it's a huge number. And they have at least 200,000 hybrids. That's a lot of plants. And types of plants, types of flowers, all orchids, and there are more hybrids are being created every day. Now, what accounts for this great diversity of the orchid and its shape and its color and the number of types of orchids that are out there? It has the ability to adapt to its given environment and has been very successful in adapting itself through its different ways of reproduction methods. Now, the orchids themselves, they've been popular around the globe and have been used as exotic and expensive gifts for centuries. They've been currently categorized and organized by botanists as the follows. So the great kingdom is the plants. The subkingdom is vascular plants. The superdivision is the seed plants. The division is flowering plants. The class is monocotyledons. The subclass is lilies. And the order is orchids. And then, of course, is the family of orchids. So again, it's the largest family of flowering plants in the world. Now, they have specific categorization. They're called genera or genus. And they are from, there are 700 to 1,000 of them of orchids known. And again, about 20,000 to 30,000 species and about 200,000 hybrids. And that number is growing. The orchids themselves can have the ability to feed on dead matter. They could grow in soil. They could grow on tops of trees, perched in branches. And they could take in the air from the humidity in the air. Now, where orchids can be found? These orchids, the wild orchids, can be grown in all parts of the world except Antarctica and the very high deserts. So you won't find orchids in Antarctica or maybe the Gobi Desert or the Sahara Desert. Almost all of them grow in tropical forests, but you can find orchids in semi-desert regions near the seashore and in the tundra. There are special orchids that actually live very high in the Andes, and in order to cultivate those orchids, the grower needs to provide a cool, very moist fog that comes in over the orchids and is able to feed them. Most of the orchids are found in the tropics and subtropics. However, they also live in temperate latitudes as well. Some orchids can be found, in other words, one type of orchid like the Phalaenopsis or the Cattleya can be found in many parts of the world, while other orchids can only be found in very specific areas and they cannot be found anywhere else. They've become very specialized in certain areas. In Australia and in North America, the orchids grow in the soil. They're terrestrial. All the other plants where they have roots that go into the ground, into the soil. And in this case, they shoot forth from their roots new growths every year that actually blossom. Okay. Now, you can tell an orchid very easily from other kinds of plants because they have very clear and evident characteristics. So they have bilateral symmetry. If you draw a line from the top to the bottom in the middle of the flower, both sides will be symmetrical. They're not like, they don't have radial symmetry like a sunflower or a dahlia or a rose. They will have bilateral. Both sides will be equal. They have resupinate flowers. What this means is that they have three petals in the back and three petals a little bit inside. However, the three inside petals, when they actually grow, the bottom petal is the top petal. And the bottom petal actually gets to the bottom because they turn upside down. So that's what resupinate means. They turn upside down. One becomes the lip and the other, which is the most colorful in most cases. And the two petals on the bottom are on the top. They have a very highly modified petal, which actually becomes the attraction to the pollinators, whatever those pollinators are. And they have a fused reproductive system. So the stamens and the carpels, the male and the female parts of the plant are fused in one. And they have very, very tiny small seeds. You need a microscope. You need a magnifying glass in order to be able to see the seeds. Now, there are two kinds of, besides the flower that we just discussed, there are two kinds of orchids. They have, and these are basically divided into two. One is monopodial and the other is sympodial. Now, these are herbs, what they are classified as herbs. They're perennial herbs. Usually they come back year after year. However, unlike most of the plants that we have outside, unlike trees, unlike bushes, unlike everything else that grows, Orchids don't have a woody structure. They do not have a firm structure like, let's say, a tree that has branches and has the trunk. They don't have branches. They don't have woody stems. So that's that makes them different than anything else. Now, they're in a branch called monocotyledons, meaning they're monocots. And basically what that means, when the seed first sprouts, it gives only one leaf. And from that leaf, there is another leaf that gets produced. And from the base of that leaf, another leaf is produced. And then from the base of that leaf, another leaf is produced. So they only produce at a time. And then they have the monopodial leaf growth habit. So it's a stem that is soft, and it grows from a single bud. And the leaves are added from the apex, from the top, each year. And the stem grows up. And basically, the leaves are opposite to each other. So they make 180-degree line. In other words, they're not at an angle to each other. They're opposite each other. You'll have an equal number of leaves, mostly on the left side of the plant and on the right side of the plant. Okay? The plants themselves could also be like several yards long. So like a vanilla orchid or a Vanda orchid, a vanilla orchid can be 20 feet long. And each time it produces one leaf on the opposite side of that stem that is produced, which is soft. Okay. Now the sympodial orchids, they're the ones that have a front and a back. The back has the oldest growth and the front has the newest growth. Now in this case, they are similar to, let's say, the iris. If anyone has seen an iris, iris has a rhizome, like a tuber that's on the ground or partly submerged in the ground. And the tuber grows and one plant at a time, one subdivision at a time, and that's how it grows across, so it kind of travels across the ground. So in the sympodial orchids, these guys produce a series of adjacent shoots that eventually grow to a certain size. They bloom and then stop growing. And eventually, the newer growth replaces the older growth as the older growth basically dies back and maybe is used as a food store for the rest of the growing orchid. And where the monopodials grow vertically, these guys grow horizontally. But they need some kind of a surface on which to grow, meaning they will go along a branch or along a trunk or whatever, maybe along a root of a tree, and they will be following the contour of the branch. Okay, they need something to support itself. Now, every new develops new leaves and its own roots, and it produces flowers from that new growth, or sometimes it produces flowers from the canes that were produced the year previous. So this is what the Cattleya orchids grow like. They are sympodial growers, and each new stem leads to a different flower. Okay, it blooms once and doesn't bloom again. Now, the Cattleya orchids are very popular. These are the ones that we usually see in corsages. Those beautiful, big, beautiful flowers, the orchids flowers in corsages are usually Cattleya orchids. And these sympodial orchids have like enlarged areas in the stem that are pseudobulbs. They're like almost bulbs, and they are joined together by a rhizome. And these pseudobulbs are the ones that store water. So in the case of the sympodials that have stems and that have these pseudobulbs, you can tell that they figured out that during periods of drought, they store water in these pseudobulbs. They store nutrients in the pseudobulbs. And when the dry period comes, they use that reserve water to support themselves and support their own growth. Excuse me. Now, there are also terrestrial orchids. These are the orchids that are in the temperate climates. And actually, I had a terrestrial orchid that was growing in my front yard. Came up every year around autumn. It bloomed. It didn't have like these fancy blooms that you find in stores, but they were its own particular beauty. They're very simple and very nice orchids, but you could identify them as an orchid. Now, these guys have underground, subterraneous, tuberous roots. And these are the roots, these are the tubers that are underneath the ground that is storing the storing the food during the winter. And then when spring comes along and when the growing season comes along, that's when there's a new growth that comes out of the tuber, rises above the ground, and then they're the ones who produce the flowers. They get pollinated and they're able to reproduce that way. And since they have tumors and the climates maybe where they're living are humid, they don't need pseudobulbs, so they don't have pseudobulbs. Now, the orchids, most of the orchids are classified being epiphytes, meaning they grow on a support and they have roots that actually are aerial roots. They're air roots. And these roots can sometimes be a few yards long. Now, when a root grows, it starts out as a bump on the plant. Then as it grows and it gets longer, the older the part of the root gets modified, and it has like this spongy skin. It's called a velamen, and that's what allows the root to absorb humidity. And these are composed of dead cells, and they can be silver gray, white, or brown in color. And interestingly enough, the cells of the root, of the skin of the root, actually grow at a right angle to the root in order for them to be able to grasp onto and hold on to the support that they're on. And again, the orchids can feed on mineral dust, organic waste, animal droppings, and other substances that collect on their supporting surfaces, whether that's a branch, whether that's a trunk, or a root of a tree. Now, the base of the stem of sympodial epiphytes, these are the ones that horizontally grow, are intentionally the entire stem. And again, they could be thickened to form a pseudobulb. And again, that contains nutrients and water for when they are in a drier time. So there's sometimes you have in the whatever area we have, it may be a dry season, maybe a rainy season. So they use the rainy season as a means of, like a squirrel in the autumn puts away their acorns. So the orchids put away the food and the themselves to be able to then use up later on to produce the new growth. It's kind of like humans too, where they put on additional fat for the winter and then take it off as more activity is called for in the spring. So now there are monocots. They're single-leaved. And these single leaves are very simple leaves. They have parallel veins, meaning the veins on the leaf run parallel or in alignment with each other, not like the complex leaves of a regular plant. Let's say like a hibiscus or a rose that have very, like a network of leaves. And of course the leaves alternate on the stem. And the leaves themselves are bilateral symmetry as well. They could be folded in on itself, like the cattleya. And some, actually, orchids are grown for what the leaves look like, not for the flowers. Now, the leaves themselves depend on where the plant is growing. So those plants that are get more sunlight, like the cattleya, they grow. They have a very thick leaf. They have leathery leaves. So if you've ever met a cattleya orchid, you can tell that this leaf is in the sunlight a lot of the times because the leaves are very thick. You cannot bend them. They're thick and they're leathery because they need to hold on to their leather supplies. They're kind of like very like cactuses who have a thick layer of skin in order to be able to retain water. However, in those plants that are grown more in shades or in more in the cover under the trees, then they have very thin and very flexible leaves. So The leaves are perennial. In other words, they can live on for several years, but some of them, like some orchid called the catasetum, they basically drop the leaves. They become deciduous and drop the leaves on a yearly basis. So if you want to grow orchids, you kind of need to know, is this an orchid that basically needs to keep its leaves from season to season, or does it drop them? Because if you want to cultivate an orchid and the leaves that are supposed to be in place for season to season all of a sudden stop dropping, you know that something is wrong. While another orchid who definitely does shed leaves at a particular point in time in the year, then when they leave drops, then we're not have to worry because the plant is supposed to do. Now, the leaves themselves can be grown as a decoration because there are some orchids that have mottled leaves. And there is a slipper orchid in subtropical Asia. They have an uneven distribution of chlorophyll in their leaves, and they have a mottled appearance that are very pretty. There's also another kind of an orchid, like a jewel orchid, and they are grown more for their leaves than they are for their flowers, because the flowers of a jewel orchid are very tiny, while the leaves themselves, basically, they remind me of a hummingbird. They have that kind of a shimmering, or a butterfly. They have that shimmering light diffraction going on. They're very beautiful, and people keep them and grow them just for the color and the shape of the leaves. Now, there's an orchid. They call it the ghost orchid. These guys don't have any leaves. These ghost orchids, they have green roots, and they grow directly on roots of trees and lots of roots with flowers springing up from the roots. So, you know, all kinds of flowers, all kinds of shapes and types of flowers are in the orchid. Now, there's an orchid called the coral root orchid, and again, it doesn't have any leaves at all. And they wrap their roots around mature tree roots, and they have a symbiotic relationship with fungi that are especially, growing with them. And the fungi actually provide the food for the orchid, and the orchid provides the fungi with the sugars that it needs to grow. Now, of course, if you've seen orchids in stores or anywhere, you can tell that they have very special and beautiful flowers, and they have different flowers. Now, these flowers could come out of the plant in different places. Some flowers some have single flowers, some have inflorescences or spikes, meaning that's a long shoot that comes out of the plant, and it has many nodes on it, and every node has a flower on it. So you have this huge cascade of beautiful blooms. Now, these spikes or these flowers can be produced either from the top of the orchid, or it could be produced from in between a leaves, top and bottom leaves, or it can come out directly from the bottom of the orchid. Depending on what the kind of orchid it is and which kind of flower it produces and what kind of spike it has in order to produce a flower. And of course, the flowers themselves, as I mentioned before, they have two whorls of petals that are not involved with reproduction. So in other words, the petal themselves become a way of attracting the pollinators. Now, there are six of these petals, three and three. And the inside petal, or the top petals, the middle petal has a lip, has a modified petal, and this is always enlarged and shaped differently. And it's actually, the bottom lip is actually the top petal, because it has, during the time that the flower was developing, it rotates 180 degrees, so the lip actually, which is the top petal, changes and becomes a lower part of the flower, and the other two that were the bottom become the top. And what happens is that lip becomes like a landing pad. It becomes a helicopter pad. Ants and bees and wasps and insects land on in order to pick up the pollen, or rather get feed on the plant, and then pick up the pollen to cross-pollinate these plants to, you know, make sure that this plant continues to live on. Now, the pollination itself of orchids is very complex. It has very complex mechanisms that they have developed and evolved to achieve cross-pollinations. And this actually was first studied by Charles Darwin. And he described this cross-pollination and the way the orchids were able to pollinate themselves in a book that he called The Fertilization of Orchids, which was produced in 1862. Now, they have very, very specialized pollination systems. So this way, they have a greater chance of being pollinated. And because maybe the chances are not as good as they would like, the orchid actually has flowers that last a long time. So when you have growing a Phalaenopsis orchid or a Cattleya orchid or a Vanda or anything else, those flowers stay in bloom for months at a time because that makes the plant be receptive to be cross-pollinated for a longer period of time. And we benefit by enjoying the blooms for that length of time. Usually if you buy a cut flower, they last a week and that's the end of them. But with Phalaenopsis, they last for 2 months, 3 months. There have been known where Phalaenopsis bloom for 6 months. Now, the orchids deliver pollen in a single mass. And every time the pollination is successful, then that plant that contains maybe thousands of little seeds once they are fertilized, okay? Now, some orchids are pollinated by male orchid bees. And these orchid bees, I mean, the plants are very smart. They're able to develop some kind of chemicals inside that bees come pick up in order for the bees to be able to produce their own sex hormones, okay? Now, there are some, like the lady slipper orchids, they have the function where they trap the insect inside a pouch, so that lip becomes a pouch, and the insect gets trapped in that pouch, and the only way out is for them to pick up the pollen on the way out to be able to cross-pollinate another slipper orchid. Now, there are some orchids that are very so specialized that lip is shaped like maybe another bee, another flower, another fly, some kind of other insect. That they look like the female of that insect. So the males come in wanting to mate with that, what they consider to be an insect. And as they're mating with that flower, with the flower, which of course is not a real bee, they then pick up the pollen and then it goes to mate with another flower that's shaped like the shape of the female of their own species, and they pollinate that plant. So as you can see, the methods by which these orchids are able to survive and they're able to meet the criteria of the survivor to survive in the medium that they're in is humongous. They have this tremendous ability to mutate, to change, and to be able to adapt themselves to very different kinds of environment. Now, there is an orchid that actually grows completely underground in Australia. It's never exposed to light, and there are ants and other terrestrial insects that actually pollinate it underground. There's an orchid, which is a Codicetum orchid. Now, this is something that was described by Darwin as well, and this Codicetum orchid actually catapults pollen sacs with explosive force when an insect touches the flower. So actually, if you are interested, you could look up Catasetum orchid pollination and you will see how fast those pollen sacs are shot from that orchid, okay? Now, some orchids actually don't depend on insects, don't depend on anything else other than themselves, because especially in the colder regions, there are, less pollinators available, so they self-pollinate and are able to make sure that they exist in that way. Other orchids also have another way of reproduction, and that is vegetative reproduction. And that means they are able to produce a mini phalaenopsis, a mini dendrobium, a mini vanda somewhere on the plant. And these, of course, can grow and are able to then be planted, and they plant themselves someplace else on the tree, and they're called keiki. So if you ever see one plant, there's like some phalaenopsis who have another phalaenopsis growing and support and connected to it, and they have a flower spike, and that baby phalaenopsis also has a flower spike connected to another keiki, so it becomes like a, you know, three generation plant all producing flowers. Okay. Now let's go a little bit deeper into orchid evolution. Now, we discussed the orchid itself, what the plants look like, how they're classified. We talked about what the leaves are, what the roots are, how they work. They talked about pollination. We talked about the orchid. Now we're going to go into a little bit about how this plant evolved. So there was an article in the journal Nature, and that article presented the idea that the orchids originated a lot longer than we had originally thought. So what happened is this. Someone found a piece of amber that was about 15 to 20 million years old. And in that amber, there was a bee. And that bee was carrying a pollen of an orchid that was not known to have to exist. And it had that pollen on its wings. Now, all the evidence of fossilized orchids to date shows that insects were the active pollinators of the orchids at that time. So this extinct orchid that, you know, was found was placed inside the current classification of the orchid. However, they found even older orchid species, and these were found in Baltic amber, and this Baltic amber was from 66 to 33 million years ago. So orchids have been around for a humongous amount of time. Now, they found a different way of figuring out how old orchids are, and they are doing this, humans, they do with the animals and they do with the plants, is genetic sequencing. So depending on the genes that these orchids have and where they are placed and how they work, it was found that the orchids actually started out from 76 to 84 million years ago. Now, also, besides this, they're studying the distribution of a particular type of orchid throughout the planet, and this is called biogeography. And they did specific genetic studies of specific organs of the orchid. And basically, they're saying the research found that the existence of orchids goes back to 100 million years. Now, when you use, or the scientists use, a molecular clock method, that showed that the vanilla orchids may be one of the oldest type of orchids that actually arose on our planet. But the vanilla orchids can be found throughout the world. Now, 100 million years ago, our planet had this one huge continent called Pangaea, where all the continents were unified in a whole. There were one. So it's very possible that the orchids were on that huge continent. However, since the orchid is from 60 to 70, which means at that point the continents had already split up, which possibly means that there was communication between the separating continents so that the vanilla, which is old, estimated to be about 60 to 70 million years old, appears everywhere. So there has to be some kind of communication what's going on. Now, according to current world science, based on their studies, they found that the orchids are at the top of the plant evolution tree and are considered to be the most evolved of the flowering plants. Now, again, world science states that the structure, the fragrance, and the color of these plants, plus their very diverse mechanism of replication, have evolved to help them in the process of reproduction and therefore of survival. Now we're going to switch gears a little bit. And I don't know if anyone is familiar with optical illusions. This is something that looks like something, but actually is something else. And if you remember, if you could visualize two lines that are equal in length, however, if those two lines, one has an in-pointing arrow, meaning the arrows are pointing inwards, and there's an arrow where the arrow is pointing outwards at the tip of the lines. The ones that have the arrow pointing outwards, the line looks shorter than the line where the arrows are pointing inwards. And also, if you have a same exact length line, meaning the lines exactly are the same and equal to each other, however you, like a barbell, a circle at the end of the line, however, if you put a circle starting, meaning almost at the end of the line, the ones that with the circles at the end of the line, but still on the line, or looks shorter than the line where it has the circles like a dumbbell. So basically, this is what we consider to be a fallacy, meaning based on our current clues of eyesight, we judge that the lines are unequal. However, if we look deeper and we have bigger knowledge and have actually taken out a measuring stick and measured the two lines, you actually can prove that these lines are definitely equal. So this is what a fallacy is. A fallacy is a mistaken belief that's based on an unsound argument, based on being unable and fail to reason and find things that actually makes that argument invalid. It's also faulty reasoning. It's also misleading or unsound argument. So there are synonyms for a fallacy. It's error, it's misconception, misconstruction, a mistake, or a delusion. So now we're going to dive into the comparison of what's going on with the knowledge book and evolution. And this is where we are. So the knowledge book actually states that Darwin's theory of evolution cannot be discounted. It's not completely wrong. However, it is not complete. It doesn't have all the details and doesn't have all the knowledge as far as evolution is concerned. Now, when the knowledge book describes evolution, it describes evolution as a stepwise progression from the micro to the macro, from a mote to a human to a genuine human to the unknowns. So this is your stepwise progression. Now, each higher dimension energy reflects to and supports the lower dimension energy. So there's always help coming in from above, from the next layer of evolution to the lower layer of evolution. So this is like us having pets at the home, whether it's a bird or a dog or a cat. We are always helping someone in a lower dimension than ourselves. Now, every dimension has its own very specific energy and form that is able to exist in that particular energy. We will not be able to exist on the sun because the sun is way too hot for us. We cannot exist in the Sahara without some kind of protective surrounding us, because again, we won't be able to exist and to be able to, so we need a particular type of body, or everything needs a particular type of body to be able to exist in the area where they exist. And evolution itself is defined as a series of leaps, a jump from lower dimension to a higher dimension. And that is done when the entity energy level is equal to that entity's spiritual level. So in order to be able to go from jump to jump, from dimension to dimension, we need to be able to merge with our spiritual totality at that dimension. Now, every entity gets the permission for going into the next higher dimension when they actually have helped six other entities in their own dimension. So there's a permission mechanism here too. The criterion is to be able to help six others in order for you to be able to get permission to get to the next dimension. Now, at each step of progress, at each step of evolution, the entity is poised at the brink of the unknown, meaning they have never been to the place that they're jumping to. They don't know what's there. They don't know what's going on, even though they've been prepared. But there's always this unknown that we're jumping into. And the knowledge book also states that the actual truth that we are being given is actually the opposite to what we've been conditioned to up until now. So is Darwin's evolution truth or a fallacy? Okay, so Darwin's theory of biological evolution states that all species of organism arise and develop through the natural selection of small inherited variations or mutations that increase the individual abilities to compete, survive, and reproduce. And it's usually summarized by survival of the fittest, and here ego is the driving force. Now, in evolution described by the knowledge book, A new species is formed when an entity fails to make the leap into its own dimension spiritual energy. So in the knowledge book, a new species is formed when that entity that lives at that particular dimension cannot make that jump into the next dimension. So when you look at the study and the classification of orchids that lists over 20,000 species in the past 100 million years, actually depicts failures of those particular species to leap into the next dimension. So what we hold firmly as truth is actually a fallacy, a conclusion that we reach based on a misevaluation and not enough knowledge of actually what is going on. So we have a misevaluation based on the data that we see. However, we have incomplete knowledge about the data we see. So I have two questions, actually, and it may pose us very interesting thought processes. So if the records that we have show the failures of leaping from dimension to dimension, then does the disappearance of a species actually mean they're able to successfully make that leap? They no longer exist in that dimension because now they have a form in the next dimension, and that form is a new form. Now, that also may explain, because the next question I have is maybe this explains the sudden appearance of a new life form, meaning once, and this is shown in evolution studies, that all of a sudden something occurs that hasn't existed before, that something is there that wasn't there before. It kind of looks like something that was previous, but it's not. So again, maybe this again is the explanation of something, a life form that comes in that we haven't seen before. Now, there is something else that is at work here, and this is altruism. So when we look at and we see and count how many species exist for each life form, from bacteria to organisms with higher body and brain structures, the greatest number of species exist in the lower life forms and fewer species exist in the higher life forms. Why? Well, the clue may be in the permission of entry to a higher rung on the evolution ladder based on helping six entities. Here, the driving force is altruism, not ego. And this is where the development of caring for others, a unification, and the elimination of ego plays a role. So in the lower life forms, intellect is not connected to logic. The organism can only function based on the instinctual allocation of energy for survival, not for helping others, and therefore that organism forms another species with another chance of being successful at a slightly different, in a slightly different life form. And also, the higher an organism is on the evolution ladder, the greater the chance of their helping others, merging with their spiritual energy, and the smaller number of species that exist. So I don't know if people have seen pictures of, let's say, a dog raising and feeding tiger pups. We've seen cats feeding and taking care of dog puppies. We've also seen dogs caring for and feeding cat puppies. So this is an example of altruism, of caring for something that does not look like its own particular entity. So what's the conclusion here? The conclusion is that, according to me, the human that is the highest on the evolution ladder, since it has successfully leaped into the next higher dimension over and over again over time. And what we believe to be true, that the orchid is at the top of its evolution chain because of its huge variety of forms and very complex mechanisms whereby it was able to survive and thrive in so many conditions, is actually false because we don't have the complete knowledge about evolution. Once we know that evolution is a stepwise progression going from the micro to the macro, that we realize that the history of orchid evolution depicts the number of times the orchid tried but failed to leap to the next dimension, despite the help given from the next dimension. This leads to realizing that being focused only on survival locks an entity into the dimension it's in, becoming literal prisoners of that dimension. So an orchid that is completely dependent on the specific kind of reproduction, specific kind of environment, once that environment disappears, once that bee or insect exists no more, that orchid dies. It cannot go anywhere else. It is a prisoner of its own dimension. It is also critical for us to grow away from ego, to hold at least another six entities' well-being as more important than our own, to efface ourselves in order to successfully leap to the next dimension. And the leap is successful when each dimension entity absorbs the totality of the energies given by the next higher dimension by following the evolution plan to be able to have the constitution to survive in the next dimension. So when we actually arrive at the human form, when we got to that point, it was critical for us to incorporate each of the sacred text energies, frequencies, and knowledge, and to continue to help at least six others to be able to leap to the next dimension. And once we've incorporated and merged with the totality of all the sacred texts, we become ready to leap into the knowledge book evolution plan. Okay? Now, both the humans and the orchids are at the top of their own respective biological dimensions, having succeeded in self-preservation and self-propagation in so many regions of the planet. However, each orchid species is locked in its own specific dimension and dies if separated from that dimension. Terrestrial orchids cannot live in the trees and vice versa. The human has successfully leaped hundreds of higher biological dimensions to arrive at its present form that uses its brain to provide its very narrow biological life parameters and can go from the sea to the mountain to the desert to the Arctic or to the moon and still survive. In addition, humans who have followed the divine laws prescribed by the sacred texts have reached a spiritual and physical evolution where they are now poised between the earth and the sky. Once again, the celestial authorities have designed and provided the path to enable humans to fly to the heavens, to the unknown and universal dimensions, and to continue to exist, the knowledge book. So maybe now is a time for a short break, and we will continue. So again, you've been listening to the Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasik, and maybe again it's the time to remind everyone that our website is www.usa.theknowledgebook.net. The telephones for questions and suggestions of topics is 973-787-7035. Email address is marymaryjohnpeter99@gmail.com, mmjp99@gmail.com. When we come back, we'll continue and maybe summarize what we've been talking about, which is Orchids, Evolution, and the Knowledge Book, A Different View. Thank you. We'll be right back.
To find answers to life's questions, you need to look within yourself. Dr. Glenna Rice brings your questionable conversations on Transformation Talk Radio each month. Tune in each month for insight into how you can live up to your full potential. Dr. Glenna is a physical therapist, certified Access Consciousness, and Access Body Class Facilitator. How does it get any better than this? For more information on Dr. Glenna Rice and her work, visit glennarice.com.
Gifted intuitive healer and spiritual teacher, Sarah Luce, brings her unique style to the hit show, Small Steps, Big Breakthrough Radio, on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Tune in each month as Sarah turns reality on end and shows us how to experience expansive results with simple yet powerful steps. Expect an enlightening bend on what you currently believe is possible. For show details and upcoming topics, visit SarahLuce.com. That's SarahLuce.com.
What is a brilliant culture, and how do we create them? Why are they important? Claudette Rowley has created a breakthrough five-step process to help you align your culture with your business strategy for exceptional results. Looking for a culture that drives organizational excellence? Listen to Cultural Brilliance Radio, the second and fourth Friday of each month at 10 a.m. Pacific and 1 p.m. Eastern on Transformation Talk Radio. To learn more or work with Claudette, visit culturalbrilliance.com.
Do you believe you are meant to live with more joy, but you're just not sure how to get it? What does the phrase, give me the joy, make you feel? Join me, Lynn Horde, every second and fourth Thursday, 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern, on the Give Me the Joy Show, as I take you on a journey to peel back the layers so you can take back your joy. To find out more about my work as the Joy Coach, including my popular programs, Joy School and Joy at Work, visit lynnhorde.com.
And we're back on the Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasik on Transformation Talk Radio. www.usathenowledgebook.net is our website. Telephone number 973-787-7035. Email address mmjp99@gmail.com. And now we're going to summarize what we've been covering for the past, I guess, 45 minutes, 50 minutes or so, about orchids, evolution, and the knowledge book, a different view. So to summarize, we've been talking about orchids, the different kinds of flowers it has, the different kinds of way it has growing, the kinds of reproduction mechanism it has. We talked about Darwin and it's his theory of evolution. We also put in and introduced the evolution as depicted by the knowledge book. Then, of course, we were left with the question, which is the highest form of, on the highest level of evolution on our planet? And the conclusion, according to me, is that the human is at the highest level on the evolution ladder, since it has been leaping from dimension to dimension, from the time that it was a speck to the time it became a single organism, to the time it became a plant, then an animal, then a higher life form, and then eventually becoming a human. Of the evolution of Darwin is actually correct. However, the mechanism by which a new species is formed does not correlate, it's not complete with what the knowledge book tells us. So, of course, orchid is at the top of its own evolution chain because it has a huge variety of forms, very complex mechanisms through which it's able to survive in so many different conditions on this planet, is growing every part of the planet. But once we do realize that evolution is a stepwise progression going from the micro to the macro, that's when we know that the history of orchid evolution actually shows us and depicts for us the number of times the orchid tried but failed to leap to the next dimension, despite whatever help it was given by the next dimension. And what we realize is that once we become completely focused only on our own survival in our own dimension, that locks us in that dimension. And if we leave that dimension or something happens to that dimension, we die. So it is critical for us to go away from ego to help someone else, at least six beings in our own dimension, to be able to unify and therefore to be going into the next dimension. And when we actually absorb all the totality of energies in the dimension that we're in and start to absorb the next dimension's energy, we are then given the help six individuals in that dimension to go to the next higher dimension. Once we become human, then we've been given the sacred texts, and those sacred texts gave us specific frequencies, knowledge, and energies, and that allowed us, in conjunction with helping others in our own dimension, to finally arrive at our present form and leap into the knowledge book evolution plan. So the humans and the orchids are at the top of their own respective biological dimensions because they've actually been able to succeed in self-preservation and self-propagation in so many different regions of our planet. But, of course, the orchid is locked in its own particular specific dimension, while the human is able and has been able to successfully leap hundreds of higher biological dimensions to achieve and arrive at its present form that uses its brain to provide its very narrow biological life parameters and can go from the sea to the mountain to the desert to the moon and still survive, or go to another planet and still survive. So those individuals, those humans who have followed the previous sacred texts that were given to us and divine laws that were given to us, have now then in the spiritual and physical evolution where they can now go jump to the sky from the earth. And again, we are given some kind of a book, some kind of a mechanism that is able to take us by fully absorbing those energies and frequencies to be able to continue to exist and go into the universal dimension, and that's the knowledge book. So the knowledge book leads us to using our intellect, our logic, and our awareness to make rational steps to ensure our existence. And through integrating with the totality of the knowledge book, humans become genuine humans, sons holding the flowers of infinite patience, infinite love, and infinite tolerance in their hands. This is the point where we can give each of ourselves to other beings to jumpstart their evolutionary journeys. And this is the point that the gates to the advanced dimensions are open to us, and we start climbing to the next evolution ladder, onto the advanced dimensions, into light, into the unknowns, into the stars from which we came and of which we are made. So this is the conclusion that I've reached based on the knowledge that is being given by the knowledge book and the knowledge that is given by Dorman. So now it is time to wrap up. Time flies when you're having fun. And we need to finish up and basically just want to remind you that if you're in your New York area, just do stop by to our focal point. The information is on our website. We start at 7 in the evening. We have available 3 chapters, of course, that we give for free for individuals who are interested in basically sampling the knowledge book and experiencing what it does by themselves. We could ship that out to you as long as we have your postal mailing address, which is your name, your physical mailing address, city, state, zip code. And of course, the knowledge book is available on our website, www.usa.theknowledgebook.net. We hope to talk to you soon. Please give us a call or give me a call with any questions you may have. We love to hear from you. Thank you, and we'll see you again next time. Please remember that you are the ones who will save the world. Thank you.
You've been listening to Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasek. Marge was led to the Knowledge Book, a gift to humanity, and its time of transition to the Golden Age that provided the truth and energies and frequencies. Now, she shares information from and answers questions about the Knowledge Book with you each Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com. For more information, visit Marge at usa.theknowledgebook.net.